Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of William Federer, a prolific writer, a good friend, and certainly one of the best radio guests that we have. Bill, how are you doing tonight?
Great, Dr. Stan. Great to be with you.
And we're going to be talking about, of course, these gentlemen, the Major Hassan, who actually was involved in the shooting incident at Fort Hood. And you know, they're going to have a military investigation to figure out why he did it. I mean, it seems to be pretty obvious why he did it. He went out and started shooting people, shouting, Allah Akbar, but oh, no, certainly that doesn't necessarily mean that this was an act of terrorism. And Congress wants to investigate, but President says, oh, no, the Congress shouldn't investigate this. We've got to let the military investigate this to find out why this fellow who's shouting Allah Akbar was going around shooting Americans. So, Serviceman, you go ahead and pick up the story there. Seems to be pretty self-evident, but maybe there's something we're missing. Go ahead.
Well, in the year 625 A.D., Muhammad was waging war, and a neighboring chieftain was gathering an army to attack Muhammad. And Muhammad said, who will rid me of this chieftain? And his one warrior, Abdullah, said, I will if you permit me to lie. So Muhammad said, go. So Abdullah goes to the enemy camp, the enemy military base, and lies. He says, I rejected Muhammad. I'm switching my allegiances, and I'm going to help this chieftain. The chieftain's name was Safian ibn Khalid. And so he gets ushered into the center of the camp, the center of the military base, and he's meeting with Safian and telling him that Muhammad's a heretic and that he now, you know, wants to help defeat Muhammad. And so this chieftain is persuaded to trust this guy, and they talk all night long, and it gets late. And then in the middle of the night, this guy beheads the chieftain and takes his head, rushes out, commits this terrorist attack right in the middle of the enemy's camp, in the middle of the enemy's tent where he thinks he's safe. And he grabs his head and flees out of the tent, flees all the way to Medina, and gives the head to Muhammad, who's in the mosque. And Muhammad says, oh, Allah's face is shown upon you. And Abdullah says, no, O Prophet, Allah's face is shown upon you. And then Muhammad gives him his staff and says, you can lean on this in the day of judgment, because on that day many people won't have anything to lean upon. And so Muhammad approved of lying and deceit to gain entrance into your enemy's military base so that you can commit a terrorist attack and kill people right in the center of their base. And so when you look at Fort Hood, that's the largest military base that we have in America, and they were successful in killing people right in the center of our base where we think we're safe. Another interesting story is, in the 1200s, there was a Muslim leader who had what's called the Hashashins, and he would send his warriors on these assignments to infiltrate the enemy camp of Hublai Khan, the son of Genghis Khan, to assassinate him. He sent out like 400 of these guys, and if some of them were getting nervous, he would, without their knowledge, get them into a place where they would end up getting high on hashish. And when they would start hallucinating, they'd take them into a harem, and they'd have a really, really good time. And then they'd pass out, and he'd take them back to where they were kidnapped. And when they sobered up, they'd say, you know what? You just went to paradise. And if you go in this assignment...
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, Williams is telling us the story of the background of the assassins. Of course, they call that because of hashish. And these people would think after they had been to this harem that that they'd been in paradise, and then they'd come out. And then they'd say, now, if you were to die carrying out the instructions of your leader, well, you would go to paradise and end up with 73 virgins. Wouldn't you love it? Could pick up the story there, William.
Yeah, so there's this sexual motivation. So they get these guys high on hashish. They'd have a good time in the harem. They'd pass out. He'd take them back to where he kidnapped them, and they'd sober up and said, "You just went to paradise. And if you die in this assignment to kill his enemy leader, you'll go back to paradise." So these guys would sneak with a dagger under their cloak right into the middle of the enemy camp, right where they think they're safe, sort of like their Fort Hood, right? And then they'd assassinate the leaders. And then they'd stand there waiting to be killed because they knew that they were going to go straight to paradise where they would have 72 virgins. But idea is there's a sexual motivation for dying for Allah. And it's sort of interesting. If you look at the details of the suicide bombers, usually the night before they will go to strip joints and clubs and brothels and they basically get their lust all stirred up to get them to be encouraged to go through with their attack, because they think that as soon as they die, they're going to have all the sex they want for all eternity. And so it's definitely a different religion than most people are familiar with. But one of the things I think is important is to remind people that Islam is not just a religion. It's a political system and a military system. Why? Because Muhammad was not just a religious leader. He was a political leader and a military leader. People forget that Muhammad fought in 66 battles and raids. He even used the catapult when he attacked cities, like the city of Al-Ta'if. And when he was told that women and children were being killed, his response was, "They are among them, so they got to be killed too." So suicide bombers today say it's okay to kill innocent people to advance Islam because Muhammad killed innocent people when he used the catapults. And so when I speak in places, I ask the question, who was the best Muslim? Well, obviously Muhammad was. And so those today that want to be good Muslims or want to be better Muslims, who are they trying to be like? Well, they're trying to be like Muhammad. And so if we can study Muhammad's life, we can see what these Muslims today, who are fundamental, who they're trying to imitate. And so for the first 12 years of Muhammad's career, he was...
Hold that, William. I'll be back here in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William is making some very, very interesting points. First of all, he talked about the assassins. They were, of course, people who were getting high on hashish, and they did this to, get them, certainly, their lusts elevated, the idea that they, if they simply carried out their assassination the efforts, why they would end up with 72 virgins. And so there was a sexual background to many of the Muslim attacks. And then, of course, we notice it when we hear about many of the modern terrorist attacks, for instance, the attacks on the World Trade Center. What were these good Muslims doing the night before the attack? They were going out to strip clubs and other places like that to get their lusts elevated. Because after they die, of course, they're going to go to paradise, and all those 72 virgins waiting for them. And then William's talking about this idea of a good Muslim and a bad Muslim. And a good Muslim is one that's ready to kill others, because that's what Muhammad did. A bad Muslim is one who doesn't want to go along with the Muslim agenda of killing people. And the Muslim faith is not simply a religious faith, because religion and government and every aspect of life are joined together. And the Sharia law is an important point. If you want to be a good Muslim, you have to support Sharia law. If you want to be a good Muslim, you cannot accept any other form of government other than one that is dictated by the Muslim clerics. If you want to be a good Muslim, you will kill and murder and rape just exactly as, of course, Muhammad did. So pick the story up there, and I think that's such an important distinction between the good Muslim you'd think would be the one who would not do all the bad things and the bad Muslim who would, but it's just the opposite. The good Muslim does exactly what Muhammad did. The bad Muslim, of course, wants to live in peace with his neighbor. Go right ahead.
Well, and that the sexual motivation. A friend of mine is Tafiq Hamid, and Tafiq Hamid is a former terrorist. He's a doctor from Egypt, and he says that when he was more or less an atheist growing up, and he was going to med school, and he noticed how complicated the body was, and he said this couldn't have happened by accident. There must be a God, and he was taught that when he wants to get closer to God in Islam, you go to the mosque. And lo and behold, the leader of this particular mosque was al-Zawahiri, the number two guy in charge of al-Qaeda. And he said within 6 months, he had been transformed into somebody that was willing to commit terrorist attacks. He said that al-Zawahiri would have him, you know, line up against the wall, and he'd lecture them like they were soldiers, and he'd have them bow down, and he'd walk up and down the lines to make sure their shoulders and their heels were touching when they were bowing to Mecca, as if that somehow made a difference, and that he would say that your mind is like the donkey that brings you to the palace of the great Sultan, and once you enter the palace, you leave the donkey outside. So it's this idea that he was smart enough as a doctor to figure that he needed to go to the mosque, and now that he goes to the mosque, he needed to stop using his reason and just obey. And he says that he witnessed in Egypt these the Muslim violent student groups, and they would begin to yell at the Coptic Egyptian professors. And he remembers one class where these Muslims actually went down and shoved the Coptic Egyptian. The Coptics were the Christians, they're a minority, but they, you know, had to learn how to be second class citizens. But they shoved the old professor off the podium and say, "How dare you, an infidel, lecture us as Muslims?" And then they began to pressure all the girls to wear the burqas. And he says within a short time, he witnessed what happened to Egypt. And these violent Muslims took over. And anyway, he was about to commit some terrorist attack and remembered a verse from the New Testament that he had read way, way long ago when he was just a young child, you know, young boy. He said he read it, and his parents were like, "You're not going to become a Christian, are you? Don't do that." He goes, no, I just wanted to read it, you know. But he said there was a verse in there that came to his mind. He says, "What does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his soul?" And so when he realized that here they were trying to gain the whole world, and he began to draw back from being involved, and when he drew back, they began to target him as not being loyal anymore. And so he had to flee, and he fled to New Zealand, and eventually came to America and had to change his name and so forth. But he, as a doctor, he says that he came up with what he calls the sex deprivation syndrome. He says that in Sunni Islam, that you normally can't get married until you finish your schooling and get a job and get money saved up and become successful, and then you can marry. And he says that in Sunni Islam, you're not supposed to even talk to a woman until you're married. You know, so he says that that means that you have to go through your 14 years of schooling and then medical school and then internship and then you have to have several years of mandatory military service for the country, and then you have to build your practice, and then finally you can marry. So basically, he says you're in your early 30s before you can marry, and so you have a lot of pent-up male testosterone. And he says then when these young guys go to the mosque, and they're just, you know, teenagers or early 20s, and they said, "Look, if you die in jihad, you'll instantly go to paradise." And he says that the imams get very, very descriptive in some of their Muslim writings of all the sensual aspects of these virgins in heaven, and, you know, describes them all. And the more they describe it, the more these guys get in their imaginations up of what it must be like. But he says it's interesting that in Shiite Islam, 10% of Muslims are Shiite, and they are in Iran mostly. He says in Shiite Islam, they allow muta. And muta is temporary marriage for an hour, a day, a week, a month, but no longer than a year. And it's strictly for pleasure. And so as a consequence, there are very few Shiite suicide bombers, because they have an outlet for their sexual desires, but the Sunnis don't. They have to wait till they're in their 30s, and so consequently, most of the suicide bombers. And I was talking with William Murray, William J. Murray, whose mother was Madeline Murray O'Hare, and he became a Christian and left his mother in just about the right time, because she got kidnapped and chopped up into pieces, and had he not left her, he'd have met that fate. But anyway, he has a Religious Freedom Coalition, and I speak to him many times throughout the year, and he explained how he was made aware of a young teenage suicide bomber that they caught right before he detonated there in Israel, and that he had his genitals all wrapped up with protective stuff, because here he was going to suicide bombing, but he wanted to protect something that he wanted for the afterlife, I guess. But that's something that, ironically enough, is left out of the discussion in America when we discuss suicide bombers. But it's definitely, from their point of view, Muhammad, the only verse in Islam that tells somebody how they can get to paradise. It's in the Hadith, and it says, if you fight in Allah's holy battles, you will get booty, and if you die, you will go to paradise, where, of course, you'll have eternal booty. And so it's this idea that you would be motivated to go into jihad for lust or for greed or all kinds of different fleshly motivations, in addition to the religious aspect of it. And then if you died, you would have this lustful gratification. And basically, it's in a sense a brilliant religion, although I don't believe it's true, obviously. But it taps into the strongest drives of male human nature, which are lust, pride, anger, you know, hatred, violence, you know, temper. It's all these different things. It just adds religious fervor to it. So you're allowed to... Muhammad, this is an interesting point, that the Judeo-Christian concept of sin is there are Ten Commandments, you break them, you need to sacrifice. In the Old Testament, it's a lamb, you know, or some animal. In the New Testament, it's the Lamb of God, Jesus. But they don't have that concept in Islam. Islam is just obedience. You just obey. There's no idea that you've done something wrong and there's some sacrifice that can restore your fellowship with God. It's simply obedience. And again, the only way you can know for certain that you went to paradise is if you die, but all the rest of them, you never know. And so it's just obedience. And well, how do we know how to obey? Well, Muhammad's life, it's the Sunnah. Muhammad tells us what's permitted and what's not permitted. For example, Muhammad liked cats. Cats are permitted. They're halal. That means permitted. Muhammad did not like dogs. Dogs are haram. They are not permitted. And so in Islam, lying, cheating, stealing, murdering, raping is not always wrong. Muhammad just tells you when it's okay to lie and when it's not okay to lie, when it's okay to kill an apostate and when it's not okay to kill, when it's okay to rape. You can rape the women you take in battle, but tells her who you can't rape, you know. And so when somebody wants to be a good Muslim, all they are, they're trying to imitate Muhammad closer. And so they're permitted to do those things. And so that's a different concept that those in the Western countries who are basically, you know, the recipients of a Judeo-Christian culture, this is totally foreign to them. But I do think that one of the aspects that I've said before, but I think it's worth repeating, is that Islam is not just a religion. It's a political and a military system. And that's because Muhammad was not just a religious leader, he was a political and a military leader. And if we look at Muhammad's life, it gives us an insight. So Muhammad, for 12 years, from 610 AD to 622 AD, was just a religious leader, and he only made about 100 converts in 12 years. That's not any big number. But he was trying to make converts to the pagans in Mecca. Mecca was a pagan city. Had over 360 different gods there, and the most popular god was the moon god, and so forth. They had this rock they thought had fallen from the moon. It's basically a glass impact rock, you know, where a meteor hits the desert sands and melts it. And so Muhammad kissed this rock, and so that's why the Muslims kiss it and bow to it today. But anyway, after 12 years of...
William, I want you to hold that thought. We'll be right back in a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Sidney William is just talking about Muhammad, who started out simply as a military leader, but then just as a religious leader, and then he didn't have that many converts, only a handful of them, and then of course he goes to Mecca, and then what happened?
Well, so he starts in the city of Mecca. For 12 years, he's just a religious leader. He gets belligerent, argumentative, confrontational, threatening. And these pagans in Mecca are very tolerant. They say, look, we got 360 different religions. We don't mind any more religions, but you're getting too threatening and obstinate, and sort of the same spirit that's upon some of his followers, you know, very, very in your face. And so these Meccans decided they've had enough of Muhammad, so they try to kill him. And so Muhammad claims that he's a victim of harassment, and he flees. He flees to Medina. Medina was a Jewish city, 200 miles to the north. And there were three Jewish tribes that controlled Medina, and they never got along with each other. They were like Hatfields and McCoys, always fighting. And then there were some pagans in the city, but they were a discriminated minority. They had no voice in the city government. And Muhammad flees there, and the Jews are nice enough to let him in. And he presents his faith to them, but they reject him. And they say, you're not a prophet in the line of our prophets. And so changes the direction of bowing. He originally had all his followers bowing toward Jerusalem, but when the Jews rejected him, lo and behold, the direction changed. And so Muhammad goes amongst the pagan neighborhoods, the discriminated minority, and he gets converts. And he basically becomes like a community organizer. And he organizes these pagans and into a political force, and he goes back to the Jews now that he's got a following, and he presents himself as a candidate of change. He said, look, I'm an outsider. I'm a newcomer to the city, a newcomer to politics, and I'm not part of your age-old controversies and rivalries. I can be objective and fair. I can rise above partisanship. Anyway, the Jews go ahead and make a treaty, a covenant with Muhammad, and he becomes a full-fledged political leader in Medina. And then something happens. Back in Mecca, his followers begin to get threatening and belligerent and argumentative and confrontational, and they begin to threaten the stability of the Mecca. And so they get chased out, and they get their houses confiscated, and they flee to Medina, where Muhammad's now a political leader. And Muhammad permits them to rob the caravans headed to Mecca in retaliation for the Meccans harassing them and taking their houses and lands. And so Muhammad has 300 warriors, and they hide along the caravan routes, and they jump up and surprise and terrorize and rob these caravans. He had a whole chapter of the Quran revealed to him from Allah on how to distribute booty from robbing caravans. It's Surah 8, Chapter 8. A man with no wife gets one portion, a man with a wife gets two portions, and so on and so forth. Anyway, in the year 624 A.D., the Meccans send 1,000 soldiers to protect their caravan as it goes by Medina. And Muhammad lays in wait, and with just 300 warriors, he defeats 1,000. This is an amazing victory for a bunch of unarmed and untrained warriors to defeat soldiers and trained soldiers. And so Muhammad takes this amazing victory as confirmation.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back in just a moment here with William Federer as we trace the military history of Muhammad from prophet to warrior. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, William is reviewing the military background of Muhammad, and really it's rather fascinating. And basically, he's driven out of Mecca, and he goes to Medina, and he establishes himself there, and as a political leader, not necessarily as a warrior, but when some of his followers get driven out of Mecca, why, he gives them permission to begin raiding the caravans that are going to Mecca or leaving Mecca, and then the people in Mecca get a little upset about the raiding of their caravans. So they send an army of 1,000 warriors to take out Muhammad. He's only got about 300 people in his military, but he is actually, with 300 warriors, able to defeat the army of 1,000 from Mecca. And these are professional soldiers. His aren't professional soldiers at all. But with the defeat of the army of Mecca, now Muhammad is established as a military leader, and people begin looking to him, and he transforms then from being a religious leader into a military leader, and pick up the story with him.
So Muhammad then is spreading his faith in the Meccans in the year 627 A.D. This time, they send 10,000 soldiers. And they have a coalition force of pagans and nomads and Jews, and they arrive around Medina. And Muhammad, as a religious leader, he was, you know, okay. He made 100 converts in twelve years. And as a political leader, Muhammad was brilliant. He understood how to read people and read parties, and knew how to play one passion against another and play people off each other and so forth, and to gain advantage. And but as a military leader, he was a genius, primarily because he was creative and unconventional, and he didn't play by the traditional rules of warfare. And his version of roadside bombs was Muhammad dug potholes and trenches all around the city of Medina, which rendered the superior cavalry of the Meccans useless. You can't charge your horse and camel across a field full of potholes and trenches. They'll break their legs. And so it throws off the whole battle strategy. And the battle drags on and on and on, and Muhammad threatens some of the coalition forces, and they leave. And he bribes some of the other coalition forces, and they leave. And finally, there's just the Meccans left, and it gets freezing cold for about a week. And then support for the war back in Mecca begins to wane. And the Meccans finally decide to bring their troops home. And when the Meccans bring their troops home, Muhammad considers this a great victory, that his enemies have showed cowardice in front of his face. And that's when he goes off to fight in 66 battles and raids in the next 8 years. And, again, even uses the catapult when he attacks cities. And so he goes through these this steps of religious leader to political leader to a military leader. Now, In 627, after the Battle of the Trenches, that's what it's called, Muhammad goes back into the city of Medina. And remember those three Jewish tribes that control the city? Well, he realizes that one of them, the other two, don't like. And he gets offended at that one and decides to break the previous treaty that he had with them. And he confiscates all their property and chases them out. And then the second Jewish tribe that the other one didn't like, he picks on them and finds an excuse to get upset at them and confiscates their property and chases them out. And it set this precedent in Islam that when you're weak, you make treaties until you get strong enough to disregard them. So if you remember, when Muhammad first fled to Medina, he was weak, and the Jews let him in. And now that he is strong, he is disregarding the previous treaty. And so that's the precedent that's set in Islam today, that when you're weak, you make treaties until you get strong enough to disregard them. Well, there was a third Jewish tribe, and Muhammad accuses them of having conspired with the pagans from Mecca. And the story is that Muhammad was taking a bath after the Battle of the Trenches, and a spirit appeared to him and said, "How can you rest when Allah's enemies are in your midst?" And he said, "Where?" And the spirit pointed toward the Jewish neighborhood. And so Muhammad takes his army, goes there, bottles the Jews up in their neighborhoods for 25 days. When the Jews finally surrender, Muhammad takes the men into the market of Medina and cuts off their heads, 600 or 700 of them, and then sells the women and children into slavery. And slavery was the number one way that Islam was financed. They enslaved over 180 million Africans in the 1400 years of Islam. As a matter of fact, there's one word in Arabic for African and slave. It's abid, A-B-D. You know, abd, it means level with the earth, because they make them bow down. Anyway, it set these three stages that Muhammad immigrated, he increased, he eliminated. So he immigrated as a religious refugee to Medina, and then he increased the number of his followers.
Hold that thought. And, of course, that's Kate Smith singing God Bless America, which, of course, she sang so well at a different time, in a different era, in a different America. But America has changed, and whether it will ever be the same America again, well, it's really going to be up to you, ladies and gentlemen. Do you like the way America has become? Would you like at least to try to reclaim our religious and spiritual heritage? Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest is William Federer. He's giving us the background of course, the leadership of Muhammad. And, of course, he had three phases. He had the original religious leader, and then he became a political leader, and then he became a military leader, and he justified lying and deceit and treachery and, of course, certainly violence and all sorts of atrocities in the name of furthering the cause of Islam. So pick up the story there. He'd actually, of course, turned against the Jewish tribes in Medina, who had actually, of course, aided him, given him sanctuary, and now he's driven them out of the country or killed them all, and he is the religious and political and spiritual leader of Medina. So what happens at that point?
Well, there's a three-stage. You know, Caesar said, I came, I saw, I conquered. In Latin, it's Vini, Vidi, Vici. So he had those three steps. Well, Muhammad's three steps was he immigrated, he increased, he eliminated. So he immigrated to Medina in 622 A.D., and then he increased the number of his followers amongst the disadvantaged minorities and then got involved in politics. And then, when his political agenda was resisted, he got militant, and by 627 A.D., there was not a Jew left in Medina. So he comes in 622, and then by 627, 5 years later, there's not a Jew left. And so this pattern of immigrating, increasing, and eliminating is what is being seen in Europe, that Europe's very socialist. It has universal health care and welfare and retirement and all these programs. But the Europeans are having fewer children plus abortion. And so they need workers to pay taxes to support all their social programs. And so they open the doors to immigrants. And 70% of the immigrants into Europe are Muslim. There are 50 million Muslims in Europe, and they're having 8 kids per family on the average. And so they estimate in 20 years there will be 100 million Muslims in Europe. 10 years ago there were 3 mosques in Germany. Today they're building over 200. There are 176 neighborhoods around Paris that have been totally taken over by the Muslims, and they call them zones, and the police will not even protect you if you drive in there. In other words, you drive through there and a crime's committed against you, no Muslim is going to witness against another Muslim. So in other words, there's no witnesses. And so you're just stuck. And then in England, Muhammad is the number one name given to newborns in London. And then in Norway, Sweden, and Denmark, the number one crime is rape, Muslim immigrant men raping European women. And then in Holland, the more and more they're seeing a crime called smileys, where they cut the woman from her mouth to her ear if they're caught not wearing a burqa. So even non-Muslim women are wearing scarves and, you know, and hijabs and veils and so forth because they don't want. So in other words, they're forcing them to become dhimmi. They're forcing them to act like Muslims. We see this this trend of immigrating and then increasing the number of followers and then eliminating. And that's what's happening in America, where they come in as immigrants. They normally need refuge and so forth, and then they increase in the prison systems, and that's one of the main places to make converts. They say that's one of the reasons why Obama wants to bring the terrorists from Guantanamo Bay to the prisons in America is possibly to have the terrorists train the Muslims in prison how to really do terrorism. And another story that I recently heard is some areas where the poor Mexicans are standing around waiting for jobs, and, you know, in the inner cities and some places, that the Muslims would drive up and say, we'll give you a job if you convert to Islam. And they're beginning to convert. And so along the border, there's lots and lots of mosques in these border towns that you never would have thought of before. And And so anyway, so we see that the Muslims have come to America as immigrants, and then they're increasing amongst the poor, the disadvantaged, like Muhammad did in Medina, amongst the pagans that were minorities. And then when they increase enough, they get involved in politics. And we see this happening. And then when their political agenda is resisted is when violence breaks out. And so this is just following the blueprint that Muhammad set. And, you know, unfortunately, it's contrary to our free institutions. But when we don't understand that RPM, it's a religious system, a political system, and a military system, under the guise of religion, the fundamentalist Muslims are advancing a different political and military system that doesn't believe in equality. So our whole political system in America is based on equality. That's what it says in the Declaration. All men are created equal. And so that idea of equality is not in Islam. There is no verse that says, do unto the infidel the way you want the infidel to do unto you. You know, that says Allah loves the Muslim who has submitted and Allah hates the infidel who refuses to submit. And women are not equal to men, so there's not equality there. One of the things I point out is that if we set aside the religious aspect of Islam, you know, what direction you're bowing and how many virgins you think you'll have sex with in paradise, you know, those are just your beliefs and they're intangible. And let's just set those aside and let's just examine Islam from its political and military implications. As a political and military system, Islam has two main elements. One, global conquest, and two, wherever it is taken over, non-Muslims are not treated with equality to Muslims. And so let's look at the world and say, what political military systems has the world had to face in the last 60 years that, one, had a global conquest aspect to them, and two, wherever they took over, non-adherents were not equal? Well, maybe the Nazis. I mean, I'm half German, but in the 1930s, we had to say we love the German, but we have to identify and stand against the political military system of Nazism. Why? It has a global conquest aspect to it, and wherever it takes over, non-Nazis like Jews are not equal. And we love the Japanese, but we had to identify and stand against Emperor Hirohito's imperialism. Why? Because they were taken over China, the Korean, you know, and the Filipinos, and treating them bad. And we love the Italians, but we had to stand against Mussolini's fascism. And we love the Russian, but we had to stand against Soviet communism. Why? It has a global conquest aspect to it, and wherever it takes over, non-communists are not equal. And we love the Chinese and the North Koreans and the Vietnamese and the Cambodians, but we had to stand against Pol Pot and Ho Chi Minh and Kim Jong-il. Why? Because communism has a global conquest aspect to it, and again, wherever it takes over, non-communists are not equal. Well, today, we love the Arab, Indonesian, Turk, and Somalian, and Egyptian, but we have to identify and stand against the political military system of Islam. Why? It has a global conquest aspect to it, and two, wherever it takes over, non-Muslims are not treated with equality. So we need to realize that it's three things: a religious system, a political system, and a military system, and we can't let those that have a political military agenda advance under the guise of religion, under the disguise of religion. In other words, we should actually give them three different names, but because they use all the same word, we let them go. I give the analogy of the word light, L-I-G-H-T. What does that mean? Well, light, it's a source of illumination, like a lamp. So that's a noun, it's a thing. Well, light is also an adjective. It's the opposite of the word heavy. Light, heavy, you know. And then light is also a verb, like I'm going to light a forest on fire or light the stove. And so light is one word, but it has three meanings. It's a noun, an adjective, and a verb. Well, under that grammar illustration, Islam wants us to treat them like a noun, yet they want to act like a verb. They want to say, well, we're just a religion. We're just a passive, you know, but they want to act as an active, you know, like a verb. And so we understand that it's one word with three meanings. We don't care in America. Most people don't care what the direction you bow and pray and what you think paradise is going to be like. Those are just your beliefs. But when you start enacting political laws, limiting the freedom of speech that traditional Americans have, and wanting to change the laws so that one group is not equal to another group, And one group, like the Jews, are called apes and pigs, and that women are not equal to men. These are political things. And then when you kill people on military bases and want to destroy Israel, now we're talking military things. And so if you're going to act like a political military system, we need to treat them as such and not say, okay, just because you're using the same word as the religion, we're going to go ahead and let you get away with promoting a different political military system. And does that make sense, Dr. Stan?
I think that's a beautiful presentation, William. I really do. I think that you've analyzed this very clearly. Have you written this out any place? Is this in any of the books you've written?
Yes, I actually just wrote an article, and I'm submitting it to a couple of places for publication. But it's called Fort Hood and the Separation of Mosque and State.
Well, if you send it to me, we'll be glad to post that on our website when you've got it posted elsewhere. I think it's a very, very important analysis of what's going on because, I mean, they're trying to confuse this issue, and the president doesn't want it investigated. And why doesn't he want it investigated? Why is he trying to block a congressional investigation? Because it would maybe even get to some of the truth out there. It appears that is the last thing that President Barack Hussein Obama wants, is the American people to recognize the true danger of the Muslim faith. Because he was raised as a Muslim. You can go up on the internet and just go to your search engine and type in, YouTube, Barack Obama, my Muslim faith, and you'll actually see him on video talking about how John McCain never, and the quotation is, did not attack my Muslim faith. That's what he said.
Right, and the New York Times, the reporter, said when he was senator, he was running for president, he recited the Arabic prayers, which have a statement of faith in it. Part of the Arabic prayers is that Allah has one prophet, Muhammad, so forth. And then President Obama bowed to King Abdullah, and he said that America is not a Christian nation. Then he said we're one of the largest Muslim nations. And it reminds me of a story in Islam that Muhammad had a warrior who was captured, and the warrior was forced to renounce Muhammad. But he later escaped and went back to Muhammad. And Muhammad forgave him. And Muhammad said, if they make you turn, turn, but don't turn in your heart. In other words, it's okay to deny Muhammad in a pinch as long as you don't fight against the Islamic agenda. In other words, it's okay to say you're not a Muslim to get elected, but then everything you do once you're elected is to help promote Islam.
Well, I think it's very frightening, the situation we're in today. It's very frightening, the condition of the church today, which will not stand for really much of anything, Christian church. Go right ahead.
Well, it's, and the whole lot of people that think it's just a religion. Oh, there's equality for religion in America. Every religion's equal. Yeah, but Islam's not just a religion. It's a political system and a military system no different from Soviet communism or from Nazism. The political-military aspect, global conquest and whoever takes over non-adherents are politically not equal. And so this is something that if we don't understand it, we will see an end. Our Constitution says that there's freedom of religion. In Islam, it teaches that if you change your religion, you get killed. Muhammad said, whoever changes his Islamic religion, kill him. Our Constitution says there's freedom of speech. In Islam, you cannot insult Muhammad. You don't have the freedom of speech. In our Constitution, we have the right to possess and bear arms. In Islam, infidels, dhimmi, which are non-Muslims, are not allowed to own weapons. We have a Eighth Amendment that says there shall be no cruel and unusual punishment. In Islam, Muhammad said to cut off the hand of a thief. Now, certainly that would be considered cruel and unusual. We have, the Eighth Amendment, no cruel and unusual punishment. So, in other words, if a woman gets raped, she doesn't get in trouble for it. The other guy does. But in, I compare it. In Jewish law, if a man rapes a woman, he has to marry her. In Islamic law, if a man rapes a woman, she also gets whipped 100 times for being used as a tool of Satan to tempt him. So not only does she get raped, she gets whipped for being raped. And the irony is that the women have to wear the burqas to look unattractive on purpose. Because if they look attractive and then they get raped, it's their fault. Because the men are not taught to have self-control. And so it's only wrong if you get caught. You know, there's a verse in there. It's an outward religion. It's not an inward conscience type of religion. Because Muhammad simply tells you when it's okay to lie and when it's not okay to lie. And it's, you know, the Holy Spirit. And there's actually a verse in there that circumvents the Holy Spirit. And you think, what does that mean? Well, in Judeo-Christian concept is the Holy Spirit convicts you of sin. Remember the little angel on one side and the little devil on the other side, you know, the little clouds, you know, and it's this idea that when you do something wrong, you feel bad. And that is the Holy Spirit telling you that you did something wrong, so the next time you don't do it. That's your conscience. Well, in Islam, there's a verse. It's Surah 2:191, and it says, or 2:216. It says, fighting is ordained for you as much as you dislike it. But it is possible that you dislike a thing that is good for you and you like a thing that's bad for you. Allah knoweth and you knoweth not. And there's another translation that says, killing is prescribed for you as much as you hate it. But it is possible that you hate a thing that's good for you, and you love a thing that's bad for you. All know if you know or not. Another verse says, fighting and warfare is basically your lot in life, and as much as you abhor it. But it is possible you abhor a thing that's good for you, and you so on and so forth. So in other words, you're about to kill somebody, you know, and you're killing them, and while you're doing anything, you know, I just don't feel good about killing people. And you read the verse, and it says you're not going to feel good about it, but do it anyway. And so this is a verse that actually circumvents the conviction of the Holy Spirit. And in a sense, the religion is designed to deaden that little voice. In other words, it says in Surah 4:34 to beat your wife. Now, in Judeo-Christian thought, it says in Genesis, a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one. So if you're allowed to beat your wife, that's like beating yourself. It's like, if you can treat somebody that is that close to you with that disregard of beating him, well, killing an infidel is nothing, you know, and you can kill your own daughter. If your daughter dishonors the family by becoming friends with a non-Muslim man or so forth, it's okay to kill him. And it's okay to lie to advance Islam. And so all these little things that if you are married to one wife, and then you can marry two wives and three wives and four wives, well, then you've lost that intimacy and you've lost that feeling of, and it gradually wears away so that killing infidels and committing terrorist attacks is very minor.
Yeah, and of course, it's an entirely different situation. If somebody wants to be a Muslim, let them go to a Muslim country. But they want to come here and they want to force Sharia law on America. And the United States government has installed in Iraq a government under Sharia law. Why would we do something like that? Because it's driven all the Christians out. Well, William, we've got just 3 minutes for it. Would you like to get out your website information on your ministry?
Sure. My website is AmericanMinute.com. That's AmericanMinute.com. And I wrote a book, and the book's entitled What Every American Needs to Know About the Quran. It's a history of Islam and the United States. So it's What Every American Needs to Know About the Quran, a history of Islam and the United States. And again, my website is AmericanMinute.com. I also have a toll-free telephone number for those that want to call. It's 888-USA-WORD, 888-USA-WORD. And also do have a TV program, and they can view some episodes on the Internet at TCT.TV. That's Tom Charlie Tom, TCT.TV. And click on Video On Demand, and my program's called Faith in History, and you can view the last half dozen of my programs on there. But I just feel like it's important for us to get this information out because President Obama recently appointed Arif Ali Khan to be in a key position at Homeland Security. Arif Ali Khan was the deputy mayor of Los Angeles. And the mayor's department, the sheriff's department, was infiltrating the mosques in Los Angeles to see which ones are preaching hate. And Arif Ali Khan ended the infiltrating of the mosque, and he's made the whole entire department did such a job that Obama had to be in keep pushing his homeland here. Obama, sure, born without being in keep security. Janet, I'll tell you that the reason was pro-Lamam issue like Obama, a Egyptian. Egyptians will just cause and the
I'm